You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right, so we're in Matthew chapter 19. Pick up the action in verse 1. It says, when Jesus had finished saying these things, he left Galilee and went down to the region of Judea, east of the Jordan River. Large crowds followed him there, and he healed their sick. Well, if you remember, we just had a lengthy portion of the Gospel of Matthew. Okay, so this is a story of the life of Jesus Christ. It's the first book in the New Testament. And, you know, Matthew is beginning to tell us of the events of the final year of the life of Christ. That's what he's been narrating. It's we've kind of moved into right around a year before his death. And the previous chapters, Jesus has actually, you know, he's been spending more and more time outside of Jewish regions. He's been getting increasing hostility from the religious leaders and from the powers that be. And so he's kind of been trying to hang out on the edges of society, even with non-Jews entirely. And so it says here that he moves further south, which he's moving toward Jerusalem, and yet he still is over on the east side of the Jordan River. So he's still in Gentile territory here. You know, I think this is a pretty wise move. You know, back in this time, you couldn't just drive somewhere. You couldn't call people. And so the religious leaders, they're centered in Jerusalem. And so if they want to hear what Jesus is saying, they've got to send a delegation out, which could be, you know, walking or riding 50 to 100 miles. But, you know, that's exactly what they do here in Matthew chapter 19. The Pharisees, the religious leaders from Jerusalem, they send a delegation out to Jesus. And here they're trying to trap him. They've got a question for Jesus. And they say to Jesus, should a man be allowed to divorce his wife for just any reason? So they've got a question about divorce for Jesus. And if you read the debates of this time, divorce was a hot topic. There were questions that they had about divorce. And this question right here, for what reason can I get divorced? This is one of the questions that was on their minds. What's a valid reason for divorce? You know, and it was always the husband that initiated the divorce. The wife was not allowed to in these days. And the question the guys were asking was, you know, for this to be a righteous divorce, for it to be one that God's okay with, you know, how bad does my wife have to get before I can get out of this marriage is essentially the question they were wrestling with. And, you know, there are different schools on this subject. Some were pretty hard line. They said only for infidelity, adultery. Others took a pretty soft line on this. You know, things like if you read the Mishnah, which is compiled about 200 AD, so it's maybe a little after this, but it goes back to this time. You know, one school argued that, you know, something as trivial as burning a meal was enough to file for divorce. Or another, Rabbi Akiva says, if you see someone fairer than her, that's so if a better looking girl comes along, that's grounds for divorce with your wife. Good night. And so Jesus responds to their question. He says, haven't you read the scriptures? So he takes them back to the scriptures, back to the very beginning of the scriptures, actually, Genesis chapters 1 and 2. You know, in spite of all of their speculation, Jesus says, the scriptures record that from the beginning, God made them male and female, Genesis chapter 1. And he said, this explains why a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. And so that's Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. He says that the two, the man and the woman, they become united into one. And he says it again. He says, since they are no longer two but one, let no one split apart what God has joined together. So again, this theme of unity comes up. So they ask him another question. They're trying to trap him. And they said, okay, well then why did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? This is one of the other questions they had with regarding divorce, is what paperwork do I need to file? This actually seems to have perhaps dominated even more of their discussions. The certificate of divorce that is recorded in the law of Moses, this is Deuteronomy 24. What paperwork do I need to file? And so you can actually read the Mishnah, the Tractate on Divorce. 90% of that, it's just going on for page after page about the divorce certificate. What kind of ink do I need to use? What can I write it on? If you write it on the horn of a cow, that's fine, but you also have to give her the cow as well. You think these are the things they were thinking about. So what paperwork do I need to file? This was another question. So with regard to divorce, they wondered, you know, how do I get out of this? And, you know, what's the exact right paperwork that I need to file for God to be okay with this? Jesus says, well, it was because of your hardness of heart that Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it has not been this way. He says, first of all, Moses never commanded you to get a divorce. He permitted it because he knows how selfish you are. Notice here, it's not Jesus isn't blaming the wife. He says it was your hardness of heart that he allowed you to divorce your wives. He knew how selfish you are. He knew the hardness of the human heart, the selfishness. And he said that's why he's allowed a concession for divorce, because he knows that the human race is fallen, sinful, messed up, not the way it was designed to be. He says from the beginning, it was not this way. Before sin, before wrongdoing entered the world, divorce was never intended. This was not something God wanted. Okay, this is kind of a last resort in a sinful world. He says, you know, anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. So he does leave one open door for divorce in the case of adultery. He says, and so the disciples respond kind of shocked with what Jesus is saying here. This was a much higher bar than they had in their day. And they say, well, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it's better not to marry. And Jesus says, well, maybe for some people. He says, not all men can accept this statement, but only to those to whom it has been given. And so in some cases, it looks like people will get a calling from God to forego marriage, to not get married, to not basically to be celibate for their whole lives. He says, you know, there are eunuchs who are born that way from their mother's womb. A eunuch was, there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men. What he's talking about here is, it was actually an occupation where if you underwent a procedure, basically castration, you could watch the king's harem, and it was a pretty good government job, okay? And so some people became eunuchs because other people did it to them. Some people, just from birth, there was something wrong with them, and they just couldn't have sex, I guess. And then he says there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. And so some people have chosen to do this because God has called them to do it. And not everybody. I'm not even sure how many people this would be the case for, but some, apparently, this is the case. And Jesus says, he is able to accept this, let him accept it. And so Jesus responds to their questions on divorce. And what he's really telling them is, you guys are asking the wrong questions. You know, they were asking, how bad does it have to get for me to get out of this marriage? And what's the paperwork got to be like? Here's the questions they really should have been asking. For one, why is my marriage failing? Why can't I get along with my wife? Could it be that there's actually something wrong with me? Could it be that marriage is revealing something about my heart? That I have a hardened, selfish heart, and marriage is just bringing that out? I mean, how do they think their wives felt when, she's like, what'd you do today, honey? Oh, I just spent the day discussing how easily I can get out of this marriage. You think that's going to have a negative impact on your marriage? Yeah. So why is my marriage failing? And also, this question right here, what does it mean to become one flesh with another person? Jesus comes back to this a couple times in his response. To become one flesh. Could there be negative consequences to discarding my wife for a newer model if I've become one with this person and set her aside for somebody else? Is that a morally neutral act? Is that just like getting a new pair of shoes? Or is it something deeper than that? What would happen if I separate that one back into two again? Is that something that can just be, split up like, a sticker on wax paper and then pulled back apart again? Or is it a more permanent bond than that? Where does the next person fit into the picture? Again, this idea of the two becoming one. If I become one and then I become one with somebody else and then one with somebody else, how does that work here? It's the two become one, not the ten become one. And they hadn't really considered this question here. What Jesus is really saying is that in order to understand divorce, what you really need to understand is God's design for sex and marriage. They're kind of jumping to the end. And what they need to understand is how God designed all of this to fit together. And so we're going to spend the next 2 weeks talking about this. This week and next week, talking about sex and marriage. This week we're going to focus more on sex. And next week we're going to focus more on preparing for and having a successful marriage. Why is this so important? Why is this important enough that we're going to spend a couple weeks talking about this? Well, for one, there's a lot to gain here. Most of us want to have a great marriage someday. This is a continually confirmed by surveys. This is one of the top things, if not the top thing, that people want out of life. They want to have a successful marriage. And most of us want to have great sex, too. You know, if you look out at our culture, that's one thing that becomes abundantly clear. People are obsessed with sex, and everything is centered around how to get better sex, how to be more sexy. You know, it's just like this constant barrage. You know, if you buy this razor, you are going to get laid. If you drive this car, if you get cable TV, whatever, you are going to get more and better sex. You're going to be more appealing to the opposite sex. And if we can understand, you know, this is unfortunate. How many people think that God is against sex? A lot of people think that these two things here, great marriage and great sex, a lot of people think these are like opposed to one another. You can either have a marriage or you can have great sex. And marriage is basically the end of sex. Unfortunately, this is actually the case for a lot of people. And a lot of people think that God is against sex. A lot of Christians even think that for some reason. A real negative view on this. You know, God is the one that designed sex. Why would he be against that? You know, he's the one that designed us the way that we are. He's the one that wrote the book on sex. Thinking that God is against sex is, you know, it's like thinking that Porsche is against sports cars or something. You know, there's a manual that says how to care for your sports car. There's certain things you wouldn't want to put in the gas tank. There's certain specifications in order for this thing to run properly. And, you know, it's the same thing with sex. It's like, you know, there's certain guidelines, certain things you don't want to put in the gas tank. And God wants to reveal to you the secrets here. So, you know, like you go through the checkout line and there's the magazines that are like, secrets of a great sex life. 20 things he wants you to know. All you know, it's like, no, that is not the path to victory here. All right. This right here, this has the secret to great sex and great marriage. And surprisingly, the two are directly related to each other. So you got a lot to gain. If you listen to what God says on this. On the other hand, you've got a lot to lose if you ignore what God says on this. This is not something to be ignored, and if you do ignore this, that's at your own peril. For one, there's great power here, great power for harm. It's great power for good or for destruction. Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians 6. He says in verse 16, he says, "Don't you know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body?" This was a church that felt like it was a spiritual experience to go and sleep with a prostitute. And so he says, and again, it's this the two becoming one here. He says, you're uniting yourself with a prostitute. For it is said, the two will become one flesh. It's the same text that Jesus is speaking on here, isn't it? The two are becoming one. I don't know how this happens. I don't know how exactly what this means, but it's something deep and profound. He goes on in verse 18, he says, flee from sexual immorality. And this is the word pornea. This is where we get our word pornography. It's not just intercourse outside of marriage. It's kind of a broader definition than that. But this is what the Bible translates sexual immorality. This is sexual activity outside of God's design for marriage. And he says, all other sins a man commits are outside his body, but he who sins sexually sins against his own body. And so there's two types of sin. It's like every other kind of sin that's outside the body. Sex, well, he says that's internal in a way that no other sin is. He's saying that sexually, you know, when you become one, you know, it's like your soul is uniting with the soul of another. And as you unite and rip that back apart again and again and again, that sensitive spiritual fabric of your soul begins to tear and rip. And, you know, for some people, that damage never gets repaired. Doing incredible damage. Paul is saying here, you have no idea what you're dealing with here. When you're just throwing your sexuality around like it means nothing. It's deep. It runs to your soul. Proverbs puts it this way. He says, can a man scoop flame into his lap and not have his clothes catch on fire in the context of sexual immorality? And so he says, you know, using sex incorrectly, it's like taking a torch and sticking it in your crotch. He's like, the torch wasn't designed for that. Your crotch wasn't designed for that. You're going to do damage, okay? This is not something that you mess around with. You think about nuclear power. You know, nuclear power is like this, an incredible amount of power is released just by splitting an atom, okay, nuclear fission. But it's not the kind of thing where you can just go home and just start splitting atoms in your kitchen. Okay, it has to be, you know, it has to be done the right way. Otherwise, tremendous damage can result. You know, as is the case from, you know, there's cases of nuclear power plants that, you know, just melted down 30 years ago, and people still can't go within 100 miles of them. It's that much damage can be done. And so this is something we've got to take seriously, and that we got to understand that failure to use this God's way will result in tremendous damage. It's the leading cause of spiritual shipwreck in this group right here. You know, if you add up all the other reasons why people lose it spiritually, it's still probably not as many people as those that walk away because of, you know, failure to be sanctified in this area. Failure to become healthy, victorious people when it comes to the Bible's view of sex. And people's spiritual walks are annihilated. A lot of us here, I'm sure, know people who have been taken down by this. Everything you've been taught about sex is completely wrong. That's what I'm arguing here tonight. Everything you've been taught about sex is wrong. You know, some Christians are really timid about what the Bible has to say about sex. And, you know, it's like they're ashamed of what God has to say. And like, well, it's not that bad if you wait till you're married. And that's what I'm trying to do. And it's like, you just feel like, you know, all your buddies are just going to turn at you and just think, what an idiot this person is. God's not ashamed of his view on sex. If anything, God is angry. I'm sure God is really upset that we've taken this awesome thing that he's created and we're using it as this weapon to wield so much destruction in our lives and in the lives of others. You know, it says in the Proverbs, there's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. And, you know, there might not be any other area besides sex where this is more true. That there's we've got these intuitions, these things that we think are right, and yet in the end they lead to complete and total death, destruction, disaster. We need to think about this. We need to compare these two perspectives, the pornea perspective on the one hand and the Bible's view of sex, godly sex on the other hand. Let's think about this. Under pornea, it's a Greek word that I mentioned earlier, sexual immorality, sex is not a moral act. It's not right or wrong. You know, it's more akin to something like playing basketball or blowing my nose. You know, if I want to play hoops, I just go down to the court and I find some people to play with. If I don't have enough people already, you know, sex is kind of that way. You go down to the club and you find somebody to play with. And, you know, you play some one-on-one or whatever. There's nothing really moral about who you play basketball with or blowing your nose. You know, if you want to blow your nose, you can do that whenever you want, wherever you want, into whatever you want. And for some people, for a lot of people, sex is that way too. It's not a moral act. It's just, it's preference. Sexual preference and personal opinion, these determine what I should and should not do in the area of sexuality. Pornea asks this question here. How can I get pleasure? It's essentially, you know, if I can give the other person pleasure, that's great. But it's so that I can get pleasure. And, you know, maybe it's I'm trying to give them pleasure so they'll just think like I'm this awesome lover or something like that, or so I can get what I want from them later. But, you know, it's ultimately it's about me. And it's about what I can get. It's about what I can take from this other person. And, of course, thinks Christians are way too restrictive, way too uptight about this, not enjoying sex to its fullest capacity. Not even close. On the other hand, you know, God's view of sex, God, according to God, sex is highly moral, and it's based on God's design of humans. You know, God has designed us in such a way that, you know, this is, there's a unity which is formed, which must not be broken. He says what God has joined together. And in what way did God join them together? In the sense that he designed sex in that way. That this is like, it's like a power that he's given us to use for good or for harm. And so there's a unity that's formed which must not be broken. He says, let no person separate what God has put together. Sexual contact, according to the Bible, is a profound event going down to the soul. It is not just an amoral physical act. It is a profound unity that you are forging with this other person. And you know, some people are like, oh, whatever, it doesn't mean anything to me. If that's your perspective, I've got a question for you. Think back to your first time, your first experience. Was it just you know, nothing to you at that point? I don't think so. I think you realized that something very profound just happened, and you may have cried yourself to sleep that night. You may have just recoiled with tremendous horror, but something profound happened, and you know, it's possible that you've hardened your heart at this point to where you can't really feel it anymore. But even now, I think in your honest moments, maybe you would admit that there really is. It really does bother you. You really do know deep down there's something wrong here. You really do have shame and guilt. You can't get it off your mind. You keep thinking about it over and over again. That's what the Bible says about sex. The context for this has got to be committed, sacrificial love. This is not something that is just done casually or for sport. It's something that can only be done with the highest level of commitment, where it's me and you, not, you know, till one of us gets tired of the other one, not, you know, till I can go home tomorrow, but it's me and you together for the rest of our lives to figure this whole thing out. That's the kind of trust that we need for this. And, you know, the godly sex perspective, the Bible is highly critical of the porneia perspective as well. And, you know, I think that this perspective here, because it's not caught up in the groupthink of our culture, a culture which is really in denial about the damage that this is doing, you know, the godly sex perspective is free to think critically and clearly about what's really going on in the left-hand column here. You know, you think about the disease, think about the results of the porneia perspective. Disease, STDs are commonly known, but quite frankly, that's the least of your problems. The misery and the loneliness and the emptiness that honest people will admit to, you know, it's supposed to be this awesome, just cool party lifestyle, and, you know, in the movies it looks that way, in the music videos it looks that way, and yet in real life, we just can't seem to find it. Even if we're living the lifestyle that we always thought would fulfill us, we realize it's not. And maybe we're thinking, I just need more of this in order to make me happy. I need to find the right person. I need to try a new technique. But the reality is, you're drinking salt water. And you're just going to get thirstier and thirstier the more that you drink. Inability to form families later. Some people think this is just a switch. Like, I just want to, you know, go have some fun now while I'm young. And then later I'll settle down. That's not a switch that you can just flip off, okay? You can just turn on the commitment switch and have a healthy, successful sex life in your marriage. This is why so many people equate marriage with the end of sex. It's because they've grown accustomed to the diffuse, person-after-person sexual life. And, you know, their spouse is going up against the 20 or 30 other lovers that they've had and just can't compete with that. You start to get into the real problems that come up in marriage, which, you know, a weekend fling, they don't seem to come up. the inability to form families later, the divorce rate has been on the rise decade after decade until, you know, recently it's stabilized, but that's only because less people are getting married. The previous census confirmed that less than half of the households in the United States are married households. It's all other kinds of living arrangements. The effect that this has on the kids. Here's another stat. Infidelity. Recent studies reveal that 45 to 55% of married women and 50 to 60% of married men engage in extramarital sex at some time or another during their relationship. That's just accepted as common. I don't know if you guys have seen that movie Burn After Reading. It came out a year or two ago. Just watched that the other day, and it's just like, this is marriage in our culture. Totally cynical. Everybody's sleeping with somebody else. It's a joke. Damaged children from divorce, from children born out of wedlock. I don't know how many of us here grew up without one of our parents. Most of us here who come from divorced families, we don't need any studies or statistics to tell us the destructiveness of divorce because we've experienced it firsthand. The distrust and the shame that comes from forming a trust bond at the deepest level and then pulling myself back away and doing this with person after person. There's a shame that runs deep, like I said, that many people won't even admit to, even though deep down in their heart of hearts, they know that it's there. There's an anger and a bitterness and a jealousy. How many of you have been in a relationship where you started sleeping with the other person, out of marriage, and all of a sudden the other person got really weird and jealous and possessive? I've seen that many times. And the anger and the bitterness that, you know, it's like, man, this is the deepest level where you can wound somebody. Inability to love sexually. Some people are so traumatized by the whole thing that they just slowly lose the ability to even have sex, to even perform sexually. There's an increased neediness that comes from taking and taking and never being fulfilled. A deepening sexual thirst and addiction, which never seems to be satisfied. Or an alienation, where I just grow farther and farther from people because of the way I'm fragmenting myself relationally in the sexual realm. Yeah, the results are pretty bad here. Sex becomes meaningless as the lover is reduced to a subhuman symbol. It's really animalistic here. You know, you think about, it reduces it to an animal level. Think about two dogs going at it, right? You know, it's like you look over, maybe you're walking to class and you see two dogs humping. And, the dogs might look over at you like, what are you looking at? You know, it's just nature. It's animals. You know, the next day you walk out, the dog's with another dog. And he's like, what? What's the big deal? What we're doing is we're reducing sex to the level of animals where the other person is someone to gratify me. It's the pornographic ideal. Shapes that eagerly gratify me without comment or complaint. There's porno right there. This is why so many of us love our porno. It's because, you know, I've got this guy or this girl who will show up on my screen, who will do whatever I want, who will tell me how awesome I am, and then will go away when I turn off the monitor. It's selfish sex at its core. Under porneia, what are the keys to successful sex? Well, sexual compatibility would be one important thing you need to look for. What kinds of things do you like? What kinds of things do they like? Are you into the same things? Do you make each other feel good? If so, then maybe you're compatible. Hot bodies, also very important. Got to have your buns of steel if you're going to have good sex. Got to have, the six-pack. Got to have, the hot, sexy body if you're going to have good sex. And that's like the key to having really good hot sex, hot bodies. Test-driven, that's another, perspective, that's another, criteria that's just accepted axiomatically, that you wouldn't buy a car without taking it for a test drive. How much less would you marry somebody without taking them for a test drive? This has led to, most relationships, it seems like within a couple of weeks, usually they're sexually involved. Don't want to do it too soon, not on the first date or two, but maybe. And then eventually you end up maybe moving in together to live together. You've already dropped all your friends anyway, You spend most of your time with each other anyway. It would save some money. And this might be a good test for eventually if someday we want to get married. It's kind of like the next step toward marriage for most couples today. The question we got to ask ourselves, though, is this perspective working? This test drive perspective, which has led to a huge increase in cohabitation over the past several decades. The data tells a different story. For example, this study here says virtually all research on the topic of cohabitation has determined that the chances of a divorce ending a marriage preceded by cohabitation are significantly greater than for a marriage not preceded by cohabitation. And so what the research is saying is exactly the opposite of what we would expect under the porneia perspective. That cohabitation, that test driving my mate for several years, doesn't increase my chances of marital success. In fact, it decreases it. It says living together before marriage increases the risk of breaking up after marriage. Unmarried couples have lower levels of happiness and well-being than married couples. And this is not like a third-party scientist is rating the person's happiness. This is them asking the person, how happy are you? And the ones that cohabited are marking lower than the ones that didn't. Man, this is secular, this is not Christian research, all right? This is secular PhDs at various universities that I'm quoting for you here. All this comes from one article I have the reference for. No positive contribution of cohabitation to marriage has ever been found. While marriages are held together largely by a strong ethic of commitment, cohabiting relationships by their very nature tend to undercut this ethic. Comprehensive review of recent research out of Rutgers. Here's another article. With cohabitation before marriage becoming common these days, it should be less selective of people at risk of having troubled or unstable marriages. This is a study from 2009. What some people used to say about this, it's called the cohabitation effect. You can Google this and see research on this. What some people try and argue is that there's a selection criteria where the only people that would want to cohabit are people that wouldn't, you know, are kind of like bad people or something, or wouldn't be good material for marriage anyway. And so maybe it's more, they're selecting themselves out. What this guy is saying is that as cohabitation gets more and more common, though, we should see this cohabitation effect reduce. And that's not what's happening. He says, recent studies, however, indicate that the increased risk of divorce associated with premarital cohabitation has remained constant across recent decades. Individuals who cohabited with their spouses before marriage, compared with those who did not, reported more marital conflict, marital problems, and divorce proneness. Our results indicate that cohabitation continued to be a risk factor for troubled marriages in 2000, despite the fact that more than 40% of all couples had lived together before marriage. Pattern of findings is consistent with the belief that something about the experience of cohabitation lowers subsequent marital quality. Again, these are non-Christians. Here's another one. The data in this study are consistent with both theories on the finding that cohabitors who later marry have worse quality relationships and higher divorce risk. The longer they cohabit, the greater the negative stresses on them. The longer they experience, the more likely they are to question the value of marital permanence. You know, that's part of the problem here is the porneia perspective on sex, which is what's in this for me, is directly opposed to the biblical view, which says, I am totally committed to you. And, we're gonna practice this in the confines of marriage. Couples who do not cohabit are more likely to accept that various small stressors are part of the normal cost of commitment to marital permanence. Right, so again, these are saying the same thing. University of Wisconsin. It's all the same thing. This is several different studies all confirming these same findings. You can check it out for yourself. The porneia perspective on sex is wrong. We want to look at instead the God's perspective on sex. What are the keys to success according to God when it comes to our sex life? Well, for one, it's got to be centered on God. It's got to be centered on God. What does it mean for a relationship, a sexual relationship, to be centered on God? You know, for one, it means that they're practicing sex according to God's design for it. Let's think about the antithesis. What would a relationship not centered on God look like? Okay, So you got the man and the woman, and you've got their interactions with each other. Now, in a normal relationship, I tend to define myself by my significant other. I'm dependent on this other person for my identity and my unmet relational needs. And yeah, we might get together, we might have some sort of a synergy where I'm, you know, getting good feelings from you and you're meeting my needs, and the same thing is happening where I'm meeting your needs, and so we're both pretty happy with the relationship, maybe at first. But eventually, you start to run out. You start to get to the point where you start to think, man, I'm doing all the giving in this relationship. What is this other person doing for me? This person is not satisfying me. I'm not getting what I want from them. And eventually you get to a point where the bank is dry. The well is dry. The bank is empty. You've got nothing left to give. There's no secure base that I can always go back to get the energy that I need, the love that I need to give to this other person. And so more and more you start trying to get what you want. You start manipulating the other person. You start using the other person. And both people know that they're using one another. You know, ultimately, you know, what ends up happening is power relations determine who dominates. Who's going to be the one with the upper hand in this relationship, and who's going to be the one without the power. And so a lot of relationships end up devolving into this pattern right here. And that's because, how could they not? It's two needy human beings trying to get together. That is not a recipe for a good relationship. Neediness plus neediness does not equal fulfillment. It's like doubly needy and dysfunctional as you tear each other down. On the other hand, a relationship that's centered on God looks more like this. You know, this is where both people, ideally, though not always, before they even meet each other, but even if they're already in a relationship, it's within that current relationship, they begin to look to God. I define myself by who God says I am. You know, if I'm feeling like she's just disrespecting me and how dare she do that, and I'm really upset about that, I can think to myself, well, God says I'm significant. And so no matter how she treats me, I know that I'm secure in my what God says about me. You know, if you're a Christian, what the Bible says is that you're adopted as God's son. You're forgiven eternally. That you have an eternal love relationship with God. And that you matter, not because of what you do, but because he says you matter. And so all of a sudden, the weight of my own self-esteem is taken off of the other person and placed onto a real secure foundation of God. I don't need the other person to define who I am. I don't need this guy to give me security. I don't need him to tell me how special I am and how sweet I am and that he's never going to leave me because, quite frankly, that's a promise he can't keep. He can't meet that need for you. But God, though, has said, I will never leave you nor will I ever forsake you. With God, it says you are permanently bonded to him. His spirit is indwelling you permanently. And so I don't need this other person to give me my security, to give me love. It's nice when we can fulfill those needs for each other, but first and foremost, our needs are met by God. My relational need for unity, my need to be one with somebody else. You know, we all feel this deep sense of wanting to be unified with somebody else, and God primarily meets that need for us before we can then also see this in another person. Instead of taking, we're free to give from abundance. I no longer have to worry about protecting myself because I know that God has got me. I know that I'm secure in Christ. And what's interesting here about this is that the closer we grow to God, the closer we grow to each other. This is really the case, a spiritual relationship where two people are connected to God. As they grow in their spiritual growth, they become more capable of being close to another person. God enhances your ability to love because God is love. And then we love because God first loved us, as 1 John 4 says. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to be in a relationship like this. But ultimately, if we're going to build a successful sexual relationship, we've got to build a relationship that is centered on God. Another important point here, I've said this a few times, This is reserved for commitment. This is not something that could be done casually. Again, a diagram, if you think about things this way, you know, if you think about a continuum where at the very, the most commitment would be life commitment. I'm totally committed to you no matter what. And then the least committed would be probation. This is where I want to be free to take from you sexually at the deepest level, but I also want to be free to discard you at any moment. You know, a lot of people, you ask them, you're like, well, you know, if you guys love each other, then why don't you just go ahead and get married to each other? And they're like, oh, well, you know, marriage is just a piece of paper. I don't need that. To which the question should be, well, if it's just a piece of paper, then why are you so afraid to go and get it? Because it's not just a piece of paper. It symbolizes a commitment where I am committing myself to this person, even if somebody better comes along, even if somebody I perceive is better, even if I get tired of this person, I'm committed to this person. And I'm dependent on God for the power to enable me to commit to this person. You know, self-gratification would be, you know, right down there at the bottom with probation. It's like, I want what feels good to me, and I want to be as free as possible to go wherever I need to go to get my good feelings. Whereas on the other hand, with life commitment, self-giving love is what we would associate with that, where commitment will be beneficial to you, okay? Marriage is awesome. Building a successful, healthy marriage is the greatest thing you know, that's ever happened to me, you know, outside of my relationship with God. It's tremendously beneficial, and yet it's not an instant gratification sort of thing. It's the kind of thing that grows stronger and more powerful with time. A saying that I heard as a young believer that has always stuck with me: love can always wait to give, but lust can never wait to take. You know, the person's like, oh baby, I just love you so much. I just got to be with you. I got to sleep with you. Really? That's not love. That's lust. It's because you can't wait to take from that other person. Love can always wait to give. Love is self-control. Love is patient, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13. And so this is a good test of whether I'm practicing self-giving love. Is it self-controlled or not? Can I wait to give? Or must I take now? That's a good distinguisher for the difference between love and lust. And finally, with godly sex, it's other-centered. It's I'm not focused on how I can get pleasure for me. I'm focused on how I can meet your needs in every way, including sexually. And when you've got two people that are both committed to these values, you're gonna have a good sexual relationship right there. You know, you don't need to test drive this person for several years. You get into a committed relationship. You learn how to build successful love relationships. You learn how to build unity with other people. You're going to figure out the sex stuff. That's going to work itself out. We're going to figure this out together within our marriage. And, it might take a little while, but it doesn't take that long. And it keeps getting better and better. That's one of the interesting things about this. Is I've talked to so many people who were sexually involved, sexually active before becoming a Christian and getting into a good Christian marriage, and they're like, what I was doing before, I wouldn't even call that sex. Because it's so far below. You know, what I'm experiencing now is just in a totally different ballpark than what the world calls sex. And I've heard that testimony time and time again. Another really interesting thing about this is that you know, in the world, the sex is the best right at the very beginning when you're young and everything is new and novel. Under the biblical perspective, it just keeps getting better every year. I mean, imagine a marriage where, you know, you've been married for 30 years and this year right here is like the best sex that you've ever been having. You know, that's what God is holding out here when it comes to the biblical view of sex. And it's awesome. Okay, how do we do this? We're going to talk a lot more about this next week. I'll just give you a few things for this week. One, it's never too late to experience God's healing in this area. You know, maybe you're sitting here listening to this material and you're just sinking lower and lower into your seat. You're just stabbing yourself with regret, trying to hold back the tears maybe. feeling so ashamed and upset with yourself with all these memories flashing back through your mind. What you've got to understand is that God is the God of hope. God is the God of healing. God is the God of redemption. And he wants to impart his healing grace to you. You can experience substantial healing in this area. Almost as though, or even if as though, you'd never gone astray in the first place. If you're willing to put in the time and the work that's required to hang in there and allow God to do work in this area of your life. But you got to understand that God is a God of grace and a God of healing, and nobody is too screwed up in this area for him to heal. Two, you need to get in touch with God's love. If you're not a Christian, you need to consider coming into a relationship with God so that you're able to build a God-centered relationship. If you're unwilling to go to the source of love, you're never going to be able to love another person in the way that's required in order to have the kind of sex that God is talking about in the Bible. And third, and finally, you should begin preparing for your sexual love life, not by going out and sleeping around. You need to prepare for your sexual love life by learning relational skills, learning how to build relationships. For some of us, we don't even know which end is up on how to build a relationship with another person, especially somebody of the same sex. You know, those are going to be the most valuable skills that you've got when it comes to your married sex life. Can I love another person? Can I build a relationship with another person? Can I give of myself in this relationship? Those are the kind of skills that you should start learning now so that, you know, if you're not married, one day you'll be able to have a healthy marriage. And even if you are married, you know, this is something that you always should be working on. And, you know, especially if you've never had much growth in this area, now is as good a time as any to start. Yeah, Lord, we're so grateful that you love us and that you want to teach us how to love as well, Lord. Thanks that you offer your love to us even though we don't deserve it at all, Lord. And I pray that if there's people here who have never experienced that love, I pray they would turn to you and admit that they're guilty, that they don't deserve it, and yet, you know, accept your offer, Lord, of free forgiveness that you're offering to every single person that's turned away from you. I pray, too, for those of us that are feeling bad about mistakes we've made here, Lord. There's many, many people in this room who are shining examples of your grace, who have been so healed and transformed by you that they're unrecognizable to the person that they were before. And I pray that we would not sink down into the despair and just dig even deeper into the hole. I pray that we would turn to you and start to cooperate with you on the healing you want to do in our lives. And Lord, I pray for our spiritual growth in this area so that we can be a whole room full of people that one day have healthy marriages and healthy sex lives and can be can give other people a vision for the sort of good things and the good healing that you want to give to people that really trust that you're good. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.